This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll hear about a surprising report that details cost-cutting efforts within America's premier disaster relief and blood donor organization, the American Red Cross.
I was always suspicious of the Red Cross, particularly around its work in Katrina and 9/11. But who should know that giving blood also carries a risk?
We'll hear about a proposed law in New York State that would prohibit doctors from participating or assisting in acts of torture.
If New York gets this law passed, and with your help it may, it'll be the first state in the country that stops what we saw happen often at Abu Ghraib, at Guantanamo, and other U.S. torture centers.
Stay with us.
Heidi, I've been asked a lot of questions recently about a Supreme Court decision. It was 7-2, and it's the Supreme Court decision that said that after a sex offender has served his or her sentence, that that person can be continually incarcerated based on some law, which I'm not familiar with. My gut was that I'm with the dissenters here, and of course, those are two dissenters who, as I said to you earlier, are like a stopped clock, and they seem to be right in this case. Thomas and Scalia said you can't do that. You can't keep people in jail after their sentence or something like that.
I think the issue, Michael, is that, and we're talking about the Adam Walsh Child Protection and Safety Act, which was signed into law in 2006 and has incidentally been criticized by many civil libertarians for its overbreadth and for the fact that it can be applied retroactively and for vilifying those who have been convicted of nonviolent or non-sex related offenses. What the law says and what was just upheld by the Supreme Court is that so-called federal civil commitments, and we should note that the states already have civil commitments, but the Supreme Court held that they are constitutionally permitted under the Necessary and Proper Clause in order to maintain the security of members of the public. And I would go back and say that the original law is too wide, because what it does is it gives prison officials and other federal authorities the ability to keep an inmate in past their judicially mandated sentence. So if someone is served 5 years...
Let me see if I can get this clear. You get a 5-year sentence for a sex offense, and then your sentence is almost finished. And then what happens at the end of 5 years? You don't walk out?
Under this law now, if the prison officials deem that you will be a continued threat to society, and we don't know what standards they use to make that decision, therefore it seems rather arbitrary, they can keep you in indefinitely. And already something like 70 inmates have been held for at least 2 years past their sentence term.
Here's the catch, Heidi. These people have to go into therapy while they're in prison to get themselves healed from their sexual deviance. And notes are taken about what they say in therapy, and then whatever they say when they're forthcoming in therapy can then be used against them to show their proclivities to be sex deviants when they get out. So they're damned if they do and damned if they don't.
Let me ask about this, because obviously we require that people be charged criminally and then jailed, but we also do have civil commitment laws. If someone is deemed to be mentally ill, can be actually civilly committed into a mental institution. Now, why is this different or worse than that?
Well, my understanding is that, yes, the states have civil commitment laws. This would now create a whole federal category, and I don't know how the federal government makes the decisions in terms of, do they base it on the recommendations of the prison officials, which is what I believe has been happening thus far? Are medical doctors involved? Are psychologists involved? What are the criteria? Adding to the mix is that the individuals must have some kind of mental illness, which I think would further complicate this.
So we're talking about a person that serves a prison sentence, and then instead of getting out into the free world, they then are civilly committed and are confined in some kind of mental institution.
Well, no, I think they stay right in the prison. That's the problem.
That's a tricky business here.
Right. Yeah, you're right. They stay
That's what's really interesting. So when we talk about civil commitment, we're talking about at least on its face, people who are mentally ill are then put into mental institutions to try and be healed. But we're talking about here, which is what's really extraordinary, is these people have been convicted, they're in prison, and their terms essentially can be extended under this law because they consider them to be still dangerous to the society in some way.
If I remember correctly.
And they stay in prison for that.
They're in prison.
If I remember correctly, the one civil commitment case that I had, if two shrinks attest to their belief that a person is dangerous to themselves or others, then the burden shifts to the person to come forward with evidence to show that they're not. It's very hard once you have two shrinks going against you to try to get a person out.
Right, but let's just say what's different about this, all the process doesn't make any difference because in the end, under this scheme, which was upheld 7-2 in the Supreme Court, people are kept in prison. They're not talking about being mentally ill and being put in a mental institution. They're talking about extending people's prison sentences. So it's really, it's outside of anything we really know.
That's right. And it's basically corralling a group of individuals. And we know how the stigma attaches to individuals who are in prison for this kind of offense. I find this part of a larger problem. Criminal justice expert Michael Tonry actually wrote a book on crime and punishment a couple of years ago. And he described what he called moral panics that happen in the course of, you know, everyday American history when American sensibilities and emotions lead to harsher punishments. We saw it in the Len Bias case, crack cocaine, the 1-100 ratio. Laws are created after a child is abducted, after someone dies of a drug overdose, that really create extremely harsh punishments. And I think Adam Walsh Child Protection Act, to me, seems a perfect example of that. Something that wasn't really well thought out, wasn't brought by the specialists, the psychologist, to find out what would you recommend to do in this case. And finally, when a judge renders a decision, I feel we should abide by that, take it back to the courts if there's a problem.
Now, what's scary about this is, you know, when we go outside of the criminal law for keeping people in prison, it's very rare and very unusual, and you don't want to expand the category. And this is a huge expansion of that category, as they're considering now with Guantanamo and as they're doing, which is a preventive detention scheme. That's what this is. This is a preventive detention scheme and not one in which you're trying to heal people, but in which you're trying to simply say, get them off the street, keep them in prison, even though their sentence is over.
Heidi, on what basis did Scalia and Thomas come down on the right side of this?
That's a point we need to make. They did not come down on this on a due process. This was not a due process question.
By that you mean?
Meaning, is the things that we've just been discussing, is it fair? Is it giving inmates their right to a hearing about whether they can be detained? Are the proper authorities being consulted? Did they go through a procedure? This was decided on the grounds of, does the federal government have the right in federal cases, not state cases, to enter into this civil commitment? And still, a lot of people disagree with that. But those were the grounds it was decided on. If it had been on due process, I do not think that we would have had Scalia and Thomas reaching the same decision.
I thought maybe they were asleep or something.
We had a positive Supreme Court decision last week, Michael, in the case of Graham v. Florida. And it's good news because the court ruled that juveniles may not get a sentence of life in prison without the possibility of parole unless it's a homicide crime.
They may stay in there their whole life, but at least this decision allows them to appeal for parole.
What's harder to get through, through the eye of a pin, a rich man or a camel or something?
A camel through the eye of a needle.
Well, you know, this just shows the incredibly glacial rate of change in the United States. Here you have kids who didn't commit a homicide. They were getting sentences. There's 129 of them, I don't know, 200. Life in prison without even a possibility of parole. And these kids are 16 years old. 15 years old and life. So now what they've done is they've essentially opened the eye of a pin. And so you're going to be sitting there. We know how what parole boards are like. You'll be sitting there with the kid who after 20 years, 25 years in prison, he's 35, he's 40, comes before the parole board, and you're going to get these politicized parole boards. The guy may have, like, you know, assaulted some cop or something, you know, and boomo, they're going to deny parole.
That's true. And I think that the main point that advocates of juvenile justice are making is that an adolescent brain is quite different from an adult brain. And people, when they're teenagers, may make mistakes. We're just developmentally, you know, on a certain level. And there should be some compassion and forgiveness and understanding about that. So a person who 5 years later, while incarcerated, may be a completely different person.
Now, it's right, but, you know, I hate to be so critical, but it's, on the other hand, this has been a long fight to even get this little holding on to like a twig to say that I have a chance of getting out of prison if I'm a juvenile serving life. So it is a positive development. There's no question about it. But it's just what a draconian law. What a draconian law.
And aren't most of these children in prison in Florida?
Half of them, right, Heidi?
I know there are a lot in the South.
No. There's 39 states, apparently, or 37, who allow it. There's only 10 states who actually use it. And of that, half of the kids are in Florida. Half. So it's really that one of that was a big issue between the majority and the dissent. The majority saying, look, this is out of step with certainly the U.S. because only 10 states even have implemented it. And in the world, it's considered anathema to the world. And, of course, the dissenters said, well, 39 states actually allow it or 37, and we don't care about what the rest of the world does because we're the great United States who, you know, want to throw the key away on 16-year-olds.
It's just another proof of the horrific punitive aspect of the American, quote, justice system. Michael and Heidi, I was amazed to see on the page 3 of the New York Times a long article about Noam Chomsky being barred from entering Israel. He was trying to get to Beerzeit University, which is on the occupied West Bank, a territory that the Israelis took over in the 67 war. And there's this all-Arab university there. They had invited him to speak. He was with his daughter and some family friends, and he was barred at the Allenby Bridge from getting in.
From Amman. The Allenby Bridge goes from Jordan into the West Bank.
But what was so amazing was Chomsky has written over 100 books. He's generally appreciated as the most important intellectual in America. And correct me if I'm wrong, Michael and Heidi, but I don't think the New York Times has ever reviewed a single one of his 100 books. And here, on page 3, there's a huge article about Chomsky and a favorable article about his being barred from coming to Israel to speak at a university. I think it's indicative of a turn of mind amongst liberals in this country who no longer just reflexively support Israel, particularly Jewish liberals.
The Israelis were interesting about this because they backpedaled because there was apparently, like as I think you're pointing out, there was more of a stink than I think the Israelis would have expected.
Oh, they really
because
stepped
who
into
actually
it.
Among liberals, as you said, up until recently gave a damn about Chomsky? I mean, to be honest, I mean, this is like these guys, the New York Times is, even I think The Nation didn't cover Chomsky for a long time. So all of a sudden there's all this tumult about Chomsky, and of course Amy had him on the show, and now the Netanyahu or some interior minister said, well, this was done by the local guy at the border, and that's why he got stopped. And of course Chomsky says, what are they talking about? He was on the phone. They interviewed Chomsky for 3 hours, and he said the guy was on the phone with the upper ministers. This was a decision made at the highest level.
It takes the corner of the curtain up a little bit and gives you an idea of the repressiveness of Israeli society.
We should understand, though, that while we're pointing fingers at Israel, and Chomsky was interesting on this, he said first, he says, every country in the world hates me, you know, basically. It doesn't make any difference because he's very critical of most countries of the world. That's his job is what he does, is not to be supportive of governments in particular. So he said, well, you know, that didn't surprise me in that sense. Every government hates me. But then he said, this smacks of what totalitarian governments do. And then, of course, what I was going to say is, of course, this also smacks of what the United States
does. Well, I was going to say, Michael, I remember when Leonard Boudin took a famous case back in the 60s with Ernest Mandel, who was at that time probably the most distinguished economic theorist
in the
world, if you like. If it was a Marxist economic theorist, and he was famous in Europe, and he was invited by an American economist, John Kenneth Galbraith, to speak at Stanford University, and the United States barred him from. And just 2 years ago, they barred Tariq Ramadan,
right,
this well-respected Arab scholar who taught in Switzerland, from coming to the United States to speak.
Right. They won that case recently, but it is true. The U.S. has a law that, you know, similar to Israel's. If they don't want the person in here, they won't let the guy in.
That's right.
But it is great, the turnaround in the sense of Israel so apologizing almost and saying he can come in now.
Michael Ratner, give us the update on the heroic Judge Garzon in Spain. What's happening with him now?
We've been trying to give updates regularly on Judge Garzon. Judge Garzon, as people may remember, is the heroic pioneering judge in Spain who brought Augusto Pinochet almost to justice. He actually had him indicted. had him put under house arrest in England, and he became very well known for that case. He also brought to justice some of the Guatemalan torturers and some of the Argentinian torturers. And of course, recently he has two cases concerning U.S. officials in the program of torture run during the Bush years. But he then opened a case on the Spanish Civil War and what happened to 120,000 disappeared people during the Spanish Civil War. Well, that was too much for the right wing in Spain. They managed in a fairly corrupt way to engineer an indictment of Judge Garzón for going into and looking at what happened during the Spanish Civil War, and particularly against the people who supported Franco and Franco, who disappeared many, many of these Republicans during the war. They indicted Garzón for going outside his judicial competence, which is ridiculous. It's just that they may have disagreed with him. But they indicted him for that. And then recently, in fact, less than a week ago, they suspended Judge Garzón from practice as a judge while those cases are pending. And that means he's finished as a judge until the case against him for opening the Spanish Civil War disappeared cases is going to have to continue, whether to conviction or not, and he cannot function as a judge any longer. And one of the people at my office at the Center for Constitutional Rights, who's Spanish or Spanish a bit, said she went online on the three Spanish national newspapers to check what was happening with Garzón. And she said, of course, that she took some of the polls and she participated in the El País poll, which is the center-left paper. And that was 75% to 25% in support of Garzón. And then she says the other papers, the other two, have much lower participation rates. The strength of a national narrative, she says, excusing Spain's fascist past and even crediting Franco with Spanish democracy was fairly high. And as she said, very depressing. So what really Garzón opened up was really this tension between those who want to put the Franco crimes behind them and who essentially are supporting really what happened during the Spanish Civil War and the killings, and those who want to open it up and say we have to deal with our past, of which Judge Garzón was key. Well, the sad part is Judge Garzón is gone as a judge for now. There doesn't seem to be a lot we can do, although there's many public appeals being made. But right now, it looks like those two, the case that we at the center have pending in front of him, which has to do with the torture at Guantanamo, will be handed over to another judge who may be okay or may not be okay.
Michael, I think that points to what they should have done in this country, and that's prosecute the torturers here instead of saying we have to look forward the way the right wing in Spain is saying we have to look forward. You don't look forward. You look back and you clean up business before you can go forward.
Well, that's right, because cleaning up what happened in the past is a way of guaranteeing that torture doesn't happen in the future. And so it just shows the Spanish Civil War was 1936 to 1940, right, or 39. So a three-year period, and that's 40, 50 years ago, and there's still people in Spain, and more than just some people, but still a right-wing control of the country that is making sure that that investigation cannot be opened.
We look at a surprising report detailing the cost-cutting efforts within America's premier disaster relief and blood donor organization, the American Red Cross. Award-winning Washington-based reporter Philip Dine has put together an investigative summary titled Labor Relations at the American Red Cross and Its Impact on Employee and Donor Safety that enumerates the effects of cutbacks that have led to bad labor relations, bungled disaster relief, mishandled blood supplies, and federal fines. The investigation examines a far less publicized issue that involves the treatment of Red Cross employees and the impact this has on the organization's work with high turnover, younger employees, and lower wages. To discuss more about this report, we're joined by Philip Dine, author of State of the Unions, How Labor Can Strengthen the Middle Class, Improve Our Economy, and Regain Political Influence.
Philip Dine, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Good to be with you.
A few weeks ago, I came across your report called Labor Relations at the American Red Cross and Its Impact on Employee and Donor Safety. And I was intrigued by it because we've been critical of the Red Cross in many ways over the years. I mean, after 9/11, when they weren't going to give the money to the survivors and others, the operations in Katrina and other places. But this was sort of a new take on it, and it had to do with the blood donor program and employees. So give us some overview of what it is and, of course, how you got involved.
Well, the way I got involved was I was asked by National Workers' Rights Board and Jobs with Justice to look into the situation, because I think they wanted an independent, I've been a journalist for a quarter century, I think they wanted an independent person to investigate this and look at it, probably from their vantage point, because it would have more credibility, hopefully also because they thought it would get to the bottom of it and not just voice one side's views or the other. So that's how I got into it. And the bottom line is that the, you know, for 100 years, the Red Cross has had a pretty good reputation, notwithstanding some problems in heading national disaster relief, and also for the past 50 years as the country's leading supplier of blood and blood products. Over the past decade or decade and a half, there's been increasingly bad publicity that's hit the Red Cross, largely stemming around its noncompliance with the federal consent decree from 1993 that stemmed from its inability to properly manage and administer its blood donor program. So I looked into that, specifically the blood issue, and what I found in short, and we can get into more depth, was an organization that seemingly is intent on cutting costs and creating a lot more management flexibility, with the trade-off being of having a sort of disposable and less well-trained workforce with all the ramifications that that means.
The 93 consent decree, the Red Cross must have done something, I wouldn't say the word wrong, but something that they got a consent decree against them. And then I guess your work stemmed from then the reaction to that. But what was the 93 consent decree?
Well, a little bit of background. After, you know, the AIDS epidemic broke out, there was a lot more scrutiny about the handling of the nation's blood supply and the blood banks and so on. And so the federal government began looking more closely into that. And the FDA, Food and Drug Administration inspectors, found a lot of problems with the Red Cross in terms of its practices about tracking blood donors, testing blood for infectious agents, and so on. And that was in the mid-'80s. The Red Cross agreed to exert stronger control, but a couple of years later, FDA reinspected and found that the Red Cross still lacked adequate control over its activities, and there wasn't much improvement. And then a couple of years into the stewardship of Elizabeth Dole, who was then the head of it and who had promised to solve the problems, FDA just got fed up and went to court to force action by the Red Cross, and that led to the May 1993 consent decree that provided a five-year plan for reform. And to make a long story short, over the years, the feds kept finding that the Red Cross was not living up to its promises, so they kept going back to court and levying fines.
Well, that's interesting because, you know, it's not like our federal government moves that swiftly. And, of course, the FDA we're talking about is the Food and Drug Administration.
Yeah, well, what's the story now with the labor situation there?
Well, the unions contend, and I found a lot of veracity to this, that for years, not just starting now, but for years, the Red Cross has been intent on degrading medical requirements, on degrading the sort of training and expertise of the employees. At one point, you needed to have doctors on site for blood drives. Then it became registered nurses. Then it became nurses on call. And now it's non-medically trained supervisors. So it's gone steadily downhill in those terms. And it seems that the Red Cross wants to have more management control and lower pay. And that, of course, means basically a disposable workforce.
But, Phil, that's lower pay for the lower-level workers. But don't the executives of the Red Cross make quite a lot?
Yeah, they do. Part of all this is a management mess. They've had 10 executive directors in 12 years. A lot of them have left because of the kind of scandals you alluded to, or sex scandals.
Talk about that.
That woke you up. The most recent fellow before the current woman, named Mark Everson, he was there just 6 months, and that tenure ended abruptly with a sex scandal involving a subordinate at the Red Cross. And so he was replaced by the current CEO, Gail McGovern. And then Marcia Evans left under fire for management of disaster response hurricane Katrina. Bernadine Healy was accused of improper handling of the September 11th relief fund, and so on. So on the one hand, you have this turnover at the top. On the other hand, you've got a large budget deficit. And that's despite the fact that The main money-making aspect of the Red Cross is the blood supply, and of course they get that free.
Yeah, I was amazed to read that number in your report. What you said here is, quoting it, the sale of that donated blood, which as you said they get for free, worth about $2 billion, accounts for two-thirds of their revenue, which exceeded 3.2. I was flabbergasted. I had no idea we were talking about such a huge organization.
That's a lot of blood.
But where does the money go?
On the one hand, you could say the obvious, it goes to salaries, it goes to administration, it goes to organizing blood, it goes to a lot of things. But one thing that the Jobs with Justice and Workers' Rights Board have called for is an audit of the agency to answer your question seriously, see exactly where the money goes. Now, in fairness, I should point out that the current CEO has made some progress in terms of mitigating this budget deficit and running the place a little more responsibly.
Have you seen union or evidence of any union busting tactics?
I'd say so. The federal mediators have looked into 212, I think it is, over the past dozen or so years, cases of apparent labor violations. Yeah, I talked to a lot of workers who, and I've been doing the, you know, I've been covering labor for 20 or 25 years, and I think I can distinguish between union efforts to hype something, you know, and unions are not perfect. Unions can sometimes hype things or just try to influence public opinion as part of a negotiating drive and so on. But I talked to so many workers from so many parts of the country who had so many different stories. Obviously, none of them were coached. They weren't coordinated. And moreover, what was most impressive was that these were workers who'd worked there 20 or 25 years. They weren't, quote, disgruntled employees. In fact, a lot of them, workers in the unions as a whole have kept this kind of thing under wraps for years because they felt a sort of allegiance to the Red Cross and to the to its mission.
Well, what have they kept under wraps?
Well, what they've kept under wraps is this is where workers increasingly hired from fast food outfits, have no experience where they see coworkers improperly inserting needles into people.
The guy that's making McDonald's hamburgers is now going to stick a needle in me?
Exactly. Causing them to pass out, you know, or not seeing coworkers not asking the proper questions of donors to see if they're suited to donate blood, either because they don't know the questions to ask or because the questions engender subsequent questions which the new workers who aren't trained don't feel capable of really asking, so they just go by the boards. I've talked to workers in Arizona and other places who will work 14 or 16 hours a day, 6 or 7 days a week, a month at a time, even a month at a time with no days off. You know, they'll have to start their workday at 2 a.m. to start driving for a morning blood drive, drive 2 or 3 hours, get the equipment, set it up, maybe start setting up at 6:30, have their, quote, lunch at 6:30 just before they set up. Then it will work 8 or 10 hours without a break. There's a 15-minute break, but the management will often say, we don't have time. And then they can get a break before they have to drive 3 or 4 hours home, if they all agree, but that's going to be off the clock, you know, so they don't get paid for it.
That has safety repercussions for people giving blood as well.
One of the biggest concerns about all this is the safety for the donors. You're absolutely right. Again, there have been cases where people have passed out. In Connecticut, the Red Cross CEO tried to get a donor age reduced to 16. You know, despite the fact that there are medically published papers that suggest that it's a little risky for people to donate. One of the RNs, a few RNs left, found out about the efforts of the Red Cross to change the law. She contacted her state or a state legislator, and immediately it was squashed. Once the legislators found out about this, they ended it.
Phil, what about the rates of pay here, the people on the bottom who actually draw the blood and the executives?
People on the bottom, it depends on whether they're union or not. If they are, they probably make a decent, maybe $15 or $20 an hour. If they're not, they sometimes make $11 or less and fewer benefits. I mean, that of course, varies greatly. I don't know if there's an average. That varies greatly state by state and depending on whether the union or not. I'm sure some of the new workers may make very little money. Some of the people who've been there 20, 25 years and are in a union make a decent wage. I don't really know what the executives make, because that wasn't something I was looking into. I wasn't trying to slam the Red Cross or incite populist rage at their salaries. I was just trying to specifically look into some of these practices and then the impact both on donor and recipient safety, and also the well-being of the employees, and also some of the labor practices. And I think it is worth, again, repeating that for long, it wasn't easy to get these people to talk, because for a long time, the workers, for a long time, they've not done anything. But just in the past few months, there have been some public rallies, demonstrations in Washington or in Connecticut, New Hampshire, and other places, because they've just decided their loyalty and their allegiance to the mission of the Red Cross is being used against them, because management has pretty much concluded for a long time that they won't say anything. They won't go public with this because they believe too much in the Red Cross. But now that's pretty much ended.
Philip, I want to really thank you again for this report. Where can people go to both get the report and more information about this?
I would assume they could contact Jobs with Justice or the National Rights Board, or if they just Google, the report's called Labor Relations at the American Red Cross and its impact on employee and donor safety, and I'm the author of it. So I assume if you Google it, or if you Google National Worker Rights Board or Jobs with Justice, I'm not sure you can get a phone number or email address.
Well, thank you, Philip. I really appreciate it. And it gave me a different kind of perspective on the Red Cross. As I said, I had issues on the national issues, but when it comes down to even the taking of blood, this report was quite interesting.
Thanks, Phil.
Good to be with you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org. Last year, it was confirmed that doctors and psychologists were directly involved in the supervision, design, and execution of torture at U.S. military and intelligence facilities. This is a violation of state, federal, and international law, as well as professional ethics. These health professionals involved in the torture still hold their professional licenses to practice medicine. Legislation introduced in New York by Assemblyman Richard Gottfried and Senator Tom Duane would reinforce existing ethical and legal responsibilities by prohibiting state-licensed doctors and other health professionals from participating in the practice of torture. The law would also call for legal protection to resist and report any involvement in acts of torture and abuse. Last week, medical students and health professionals descended on Albany in their lab whites to meet with lawmakers to advocate the passage of this historic legislation. Among its advocates are Dr. Alan Keller, who runs a center for torture survivors. He joins us today. Welcome, Alan, to Law and Disorder.
Privileged to be here.
I understand you're on the way back from Albany. What were you doing up in Albany?
I was in Albany with a group of 15 medical students. We were meeting with legislators about a bill calling for accountability in torture. Specifically, the legislation is about medical participation in torture. The proposed legislation, which has been proposed by New York State Assemblyman Dick Gottfried and State Senator Tom Duane, says that if you are a health professional who participated in torture, you can lose your license. And after yesterday, we're very energized and hopeful that this legislation will pass, even this term.
That's remarkable. Now, it comes out of course, a particular experience in the last few years. Is that right?
That's correct. I believe that accountability for torture, and specifically U.S. participation in torture in the, quote, war on terror, is really one of the great tragedies and moral imperatives of our time. And the more we learn about what happened, the more we know that health professionals were front and center and complicit in this policy of torture and also in its implementation. Specifically, medical professionals were there in developing and recommending the use of these methods. Medical professionals provided sanitization and rationalization for those infamous torture memos in terms of that these were not harmful methods. Medical professionals, it's been documented, were present during the use of enhanced interrogation methods and other torture methods. So on a whole host of levels, yes, it's one of the darker chapters, I believe, in our country's and in our medical profession's history.
I've also read that one of the functions that physicians have performed during these sessions is to actually resuscitate a prisoner during an interrogation so that the prisoner can be further punished and treated inhumanely.
Yes, according to the released Inspector General report from the CIA, which was released at the end of last summer, it actually documented that they were calling, as part of their methodology, if you want to call it as such, that there would be at the head of, when somebody was being waterboarded, there would be a doctor there, as if somehow that makes, you know, this mock drowning safer.
Great.
Also, medical professionals, including former detainees from Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo that I personally interviewed, reported that medical professionals, while they were held in a room that was very, very hot or very, very cold, health professionals would come in, take their vital signs, as if somehow this makes it safe. This, in my opinion, is not my opinion. This is clearly a breach of medical and professional ethics, and we need to make sure it doesn't happen again.
It's already illegal to abuse somebody. It's already unethical in terms of the oath doctors take to make somebody worse off than when you found them. Why is this legislation necessary?
This legislation is necessary for several reasons. First, the sordid history that we've had. Second, a need for accountability. Medical professionals, when they practice their profession, whether they're doing so in New York State, in Guantanamo, in Afghanistan, anywhere, they are doing so because they have a medical license. And those licenses are issued by the state, not by the federal government, not by the Army, not by the CIA, not by whoever. They are issued by the states. And so it's essential that the states regulate this. Now, as I mentioned, professional societies have as part of their codes of ethics, health professionals cannot participate in torture. But there's really, in terms of, you know, teeth to this, there's really nothing. A professional society, I guess, can throw someone out. Individuals cannot practice in the health professions without a license. And so the state is exactly where this regulation needs to be.
It seems to me that this regulation could serve a larger good, and that is removing medical professionals from the process may actually render the implementation of torture more difficult in the long run, especially if the public finds out how it's being done and how repugnant less sanitized procedures are. I do think that having doctors there in a way legitimizes it.
I couldn't agree with you more, and that's why they shouldn't be there. This bill does a lot of really important things. One, it allows a mechanism for accountability. And it doesn't say a health professional will lose their license. It says a complaint can and be filed, and that if there's appropriate information, there'll be a procedure. And one thing that can happen is loss of license. So that accountability, first of all, is key. Number two, I think there's a really important preventive effect. We know that it's easier for health professionals, it's easier actually for most people to do these kind of things, to participate in torture than we'd like to think. And so this legislation also sends a message to health professionals who are put in untenable positions saying, look, I can't do this. If I do this, I will lose my license. So even though one would hope the higher calling and common sense would be enough, having that preventive component is important as well.
I've been dismayed that lawyers who have engaged in facilitating torture, the ones that wrote the memos saying that it was legal when clearly it wasn't, nothing's been done to them. They're governed by local state bar associations, and there's been no charges against any of these people. What concerns me is I think that the American public was so scared after 9/11 that in their majority, they went along with the torture programs.
I couldn't agree with you more. I believe there is a need for real accounting and accountability with lawyers and physicians. I also, though, with both of these things, we need to have mechanisms in place to make sure this doesn't happen again. And with regards to the lawyers and the, quote, torture memos, they relied heavily on medical opinions. And arguably, if not for the medical cover, looted rationalizations, those memos could not or would not have gone forward.
That's quite an important point.
And I hope that state bar associations take appropriate measures as well. And I think actually there's an important parallel there, that there needs to be accounting at the federal level, criminal charges when appropriate, but issues of licensing. There was a case, for example, in California where allegedly a physician who worked at Guantanamo and who was involved in sharing of medical information with interrogators so that, okay, use this piece of information to the advantage. A charge was brought, a complaint filed with the California Medical Board, and they said, look, this isn't in our jurisdiction. So everybody's pointing to everybody else. So I think we need, you know, a multifaceted approach, a multi-pronged approach, and the state licensing, and arguably similarly with the bar associations. That's a key place to go and to have accountability and also crucial prevention. Because I agree, you know, the public was terrified. There was this misconception that somehow this made us safer. The more we learn, we know it's not effective. It didn't make us safer. And I still am very worried that, you know, we're only another incident away from us, in our fear, turning back to these methods. We need to have systems in place to make sure that doesn't happen.
Let me ask you a question about other doctors and other medical personnel. This includes, of course, psychologists, a whole range of medical personnel who both helped design the torture and abuse as well as monitored it, if you want to consider it, and no positive implication of that word. But there was some split on this issue, I know, and there still may be some split. And I'm not familiar completely with it, with the American Psychological Association and some of their people cooperating. And
let me give you a little background on that. So first of all, the state chapter of the New York Psychological Association has endorsed this bill.
That's great.
I encourage your listeners, please, and actually the time is now, it's over the next few weeks are key, to go to the website www.stoptortureny.org. Sign the online petition. It automatically generates emails to the state legislators. So please do that.
Say it again, Alan.
stoptortureny.org.
Great.
So the New York State Psychological Association has endorsed this. The American Psychological Association, their issue is as follows. This legislation, in addition to banning medical participation in torture, it also bans medical or health professional participation in interrogations. And this is not to say that all or most interrogations are torture, but it's simply to say that health professionals do not have a place in the actual interrogation room. They can still provide training to interrogators. They can do medical, psychological evaluations of individuals in detention, but they shouldn't be in interrogations. It's a co-opting and corrupting dual loyalty. And we know, too, from looking at the experience of what happened in Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo, that having a health provider there, the argument is, oh, won't this somehow make the system more safer? That's baloney. What happens, I believe, is the interrogator looks to the medical professional and says, well, if it gets really out of hand, they'll stop me. The medical person is like, well, it's not so bad. You know, they're there at the behest of the military. And it actually becomes an enabler rather than a preventer. So The American Psychological Association, unfortunately, is completely out of step with every other health professional organization, at least with regards to interrogations. I will say that they, too, have clearly said that there's no place for health professionals to participate in torture.
I can see another advantage of this, and I believe you were starting to refer to this earlier in terms of giving teeth to the existing medical canons of ethics, and that is that if doctors and other medical personnel are put against the sort of heavy hand of the state, the government saying, you have to do this, we need you to do this, it might be difficult for medical experts who are used to treating patients and aren't necessarily political animals to stand up to the heavy arm of government. And I would think this would make it a lot easier to say no.
I think so, precisely. I mean, the bottom line is when we look, for example, at Abu Ghraib as an example, I have no doubt there were individuals, sociopaths, whatever, who did this. But I was always struck by the normalcy looking at the individuals who were doing this. And I used to think torture is done by two-headed monsters. No. That's not true. It's easier for individuals, including health professionals, to be co-opted. One other thing I should say about our visit to Albany, I was there with a group of 15 medical students. We were all in our white coats because we were there as health professionals. And it was really inspiring. I mean, when I was in medical school, I barely had time to get my laundry done. And here was a group of 15 med students and myself, and we had, I think, over 25 meetings running around and advocating for this. So the future generation of health professionals gets this.
That's great.
It's wonderful that you did that.
And so we need to make sure our state legislators get this as well. And so I know, you know, there's always reasons not to move a bill and other things, but we really need to encourage movement. So I encourage all of your listeners, too, to sign that petition, to contact the state senator's offices, contact Senator Tom Duane's office and Assemblymember Gottfried's office and say, we want this legislation and we want it now.
This is great.
This is actually the time to pass it.
Well, Dr. Kelly, we're going to link StopTortureNY.org to our website, lawanddisorder.org, so that we can facilitate you and the medical students in this work.
No, this is amazing work, and I know if New York gets this bill, it's going to be the first state in the country. I know that we're looking at it at some other places.
Five other states where similar legislation, I believe, is being considered. You know, at least another chapter in trying to get this right, and a really important step, both symbolically and also substantively.
Tell us in a couple of sentences what you do in New York, because this is a really special facility in New York that you run, and it's very, very important to all of us. So why don't you tell us what it is?
Well, thank you. We've actually had the privilege of collaborating with the Center for Constitutional Rights, the group's Human Rights First, Human Rights Watch. So I have the privilege of being director of the Bellevue NYU Program for Survivors of Torture. This program provides comprehensive medical, mental health, social and legal services to refugees and immigrants from all over the world. We've now cared for 3,000 men, women, and children since we started. We get 5 to 10 new referrals a week. So the Tibetan monk who was arrested and tortured for chanting, "Long live the Dalai Lama, free Tibet," comes to us. The African student activist who was tortured. Individuals persecuted because of their sexual orientation. Women subjected to female genital mutilation. So we are swamped. We actually right now have a several-month waiting list, and the website for our program is survivorsoftorture.org. And I will tell you, your listeners, we really need your support. Last year was a rough year. We had to lay off several staff. Fortunately, we're rebounding a bit, but we certainly can need help. I also should mention I have the privilege of being on the advisory board of Physicians for Human Rights, a group that has also really been at the forefront of speaking out on this issue, and a lot of the work, including examining former prisoners from Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo, I did in collaboration with them.
So that would be another interview with you, because I know we've talked about it personally, and it's extraordinary work you do, Alan. Thank you, and everybody really who works with you, and this is a great effort on the bill, and I encourage every listener who hears Alan and hears this show to go to the website. Again, the website is, Alan?
StopTortureNY.org.
And support this important legislation. Thank you, Alan.
Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you, Doctor.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
Use that somewhere, dear.